You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2002 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the second class in a series given by Brother John Halliwell on the subject, The Life of David. This class is titled, David the Soldier.
This is when the bell was ringing of the phrase, ask not for whom the bell tolls. If you're still having a coffee, it tolls for thee. Well, you remember that we left David and Jonathan yesterday, taking their separate paths. Jonathan returning to the city and to the court of his father Saul, and David to dens and caves of the earth. And this morning's class is concerned with David as a soldier and his experiences before he became king. Jonathan went to the city, and David went to the house of God in the days of Abiathar the priest, as the Lord Jesus informs us in Mark's Gospel. He was unwelcome at the king's table. He was unable to go home to Bethlehem, the house of bread. And so he went to God's house, and there he ate the showbread. The bread of the presence, which it was not lawful, strictly speaking, for him to eat. It was only for the priests. And yet, it seems they too were in dire straits. There was no other bread. And I wonder if that tells us something very sad about Saul, who had now begun to neglect even the service of God. And so, even God's priests were hungry. So, David also fled without weapons. If there was no food, at last he might find a sword there, or a spear in the tent of God. When he went there, David, well, to use a phrase by a famous British civil servant, David was economical with the truth. It was true that that's not quite a lie. It's just not telling the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And so, in a sense, David did the same. It was true that haste had been necessary because he had to flee. It was the king's business, but not Saul's business. It was the true king, David's business. And having been there with the tabernacle with Abiathar, then David went on to Gath. It's a strange decision, that, isn't it? We're now in 1 Samuel 21 and onwards. Why did he go to Gath? Well, I think the real point was that that would be the last place that Saul would look for him. To go into the camp of the enemy, to go to Achish, king of Gath, Goliath's city, would be the last place that Saul would expect to find him. But of course there were dangers. The servants of Achish, 1 Samuel 21:11 onwards tells us, said to the king, "Is this not David, the king of the land?" He wasn't really in official terms, but they had begun to recognize that he was the effective king. Did they not sing one to another of him in their dances, saying, "Saul has slain his thousands, but David his tens of thousands"? And David laid this up in his heart and was afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. So from this passage we realize that as far as the Philistines were concerned, David was the real leader of God's people. And then they must have asked themselves, well, why is this man now coming to us to seek sanctuary? And David's anxiety shows how desperate his condition was, because fear was not a normal attribute or characteristic of God's king. He then resolved to feign madness as a means of protection. And there's a lovely passage in the writings of the late Brother Harry Whittaker, in his book on Samuel, Saul and David. And I'd like to read that because I couldn't express it better, even if I tried. He writes, "Achish recoiled from the sight in contempt and loathing. 'Take the animal away,' he ordered in disgust. 'Haven't I got loonies enough amongst you without importing them from Israel? Send him back to where he came from. Saul is mad. David is mad. But then, what do you expect from a people who worship a God they can't even see?" And so, for a moment perhaps, David would have felt some security in Achish's household, but this madness was a reason why eventually he was discharged. Now, some of us may have ethical problems here. Why did David use this subterfuge of pretending to be mad? But he was in fear of his life. And so we must be wary in passing judgment on the man after God's own heart. And so in chapter 22, he moves to the cave of Adullam. Now, one of the sad things, of course, was that David's danger then spread to his family. His brethren and his entire father's house were automatically regarded by Saul as his enemies. And so others too were moved to join David. And so in 1 Samuel 22 verse 1, it goes on to say that he escaped to the cave of Adullam. When his brethren and all his father's house heard it, they went down thither to him. And then it says, everyone that was in distress, and everyone that was in debt, and everyone that was discontented, and the AV, or the King James margin, says bitter of soul. Isn't that lovely? Everyone that was bitter of soul gathered themselves unto him, and he became captain over them, and there were with him about 400 men. And in the Chronicles account, in 1 Chronicles 12, we're told that other men came from Saul. Men who were wonderful warriors. They were ambidextrous. They could shoot the bow or sling the sling with right hand or left. Men came from Israel, from Saul's domain, to David's. 400. His father and mother, of course, were committed to the safekeeping of the king of Moab, possibly because of the distant relatives through the line of Ruth. And of course, it goes on in the third and fourth verses where David does this, and he asks the king to look after them till I know what God will do for me. Again, the spirituality of David comes forward there, doesn't it? Till I know what God will do for me. Tradition says, of course, the king of Moab betrayed his trust, and that's why David was very severe later on the Moabites. And at this stage, the strange character of Saul is revealed. You remember the question of Doeg the Edomite? There's a period when Saul, in verse 7, begs for pity from his own people, and yet he shows none himself. He slays the priest by the hand of Doeg the Edomite, and then only Abiathar can escape to David. And so into chapter 23, though David had problems of his own, he's very willing to help others. And when he learned that the Philistines had been raiding Keilah, he went to inquire of the Lord as to whether he should help them. Of course, it's most likely that Abiathar had brought the ephod and therefore the Urim and Thummim with him, and so they could inquire of the Lord. And the answer was clear enough. Go and smite the Philistines and save Keilah. David's men thought that would be foolhardy. They were in fear in their own land that it would be much worse if they went to the Philistine territory. But God's counsel was sought once more, and reassurance came that God would deliver the Philistines into David's hand, and that was sufficient for him. Victory was assured. And of course now they had a city where they would be welcome. Having released them from the hand of the Philistines, the men of Keilah ought to have been grateful to David. Here was a city unlike Gath, where they would be welcome and have sanctuary. But there is a problem. You see, city gates and city walls keep the enemy out, but they keep you in. And it could be a trap. Saul realized this and went off in haste with his troops to take David within the walls of Keilah. And once again David inquired of the Lord, will Saul come? Yes. Will the citizens of Keilah surrender me? Yes. How typical of human nature. David had helped them when they were helpless, at great risk to himself. Now they would betray him. What a thankless lot. And our minds go forward, don't they, at least 1,000 years to the same attitude that Israel had towards David's greater son. So he must leave Keilah. So it says in 1 Samuel 23:13, David and his men, which were about 600, 200 more have joined. They arose and departed out of Keilah and went whithersoever they could go. They were fugitives. It's interesting, I think, that David could weld these men to come back to this in our final study, he could take men who'd come to him. He didn't choose them. He didn't select these men, the discontents, those in debt, those who had problems. They came to David, and he transformed them into an incredible fighting force. Well, they left Keilah, and they went to the wilderness, the mountains, and the woodland of Ziph. And I suppose just as David's spirits must have been at their lowest ebb, a visitor came. And the record says in verse 16, and Jonathan's son Saul, Jonathan Saul's son arose and went to David in the wood and strengthened his hand in God. Isn't that a lovely phrase? Jonathan strengthened his hand in God. It's a wonderful description, isn't it, of the mutual care that we should have one for another when one is low and the other is in high spirit spiritually. It's our duty to strengthen each other, strengthen our hands in God. But even more interesting, have you noticed, Jonathan could find David wherever he was hiding, but Saul couldn't. And I wonder if this tells us that Israel's loyalty to Saul was beginning to wane. People were willing to tell Jonathan where David was, but not willing to tell Saul. Jonathan knew that David would be king, and he would be content to serve in David's kingdom. And like John the Baptist, he was taking the line, he must increase, and I must decrease. What a wonderful character Jonathan proved to be. Well, the Ziphites betrayed David to Saul, and so David was forced to move on again now to the wilderness of Maon. And sometimes discovery by Saul was a very near thing. The record tells in verse 26, occasionally Saul went one side of the mountain while David's men were moving the other side, just a mountain's distance apart. And then the Philistines came to David's aid, unknowingly on his part, because a messenger came to Saul saying, haste, come, the Philistines have made a raid on the land. And so it was a case where Saul had to leave his hunting for David and fight the Philistines. And it says, David went up from thence and dwelt in the strongholds of En-Gedi. Now, En-Gedi is today in a desert area on the edge of the Dead Sea. It has a perpetual spring and a large number of caves and crags with precipitous sides, the ideal place to hide out. And even now, some 3,000 years later, when you visit the site, somehow, well, for me, you could feel the spirit of David there. There's an overhang of a rock near the stream, and under it is a ledge where you can sit. And my perhaps too vivid imagination could see in my mind's eye David sitting there with his chief commanders, plotting how they would try to defend themselves from Saul. With his staff discussing tactics, with the stream tinkling by the side of them. And any one of the caves that are in the cliff face would be a place where his men could quickly hide if Saul came. Well, in chapter 24, we're told that the spies, in fact, did locate David. And so Saul came with 3,000 men against David's 600. A ratio, I think, if my maths is right, of 5-1. Well, while David and his men hid in one of the caves, Saul chose it as, well, in Britain we'd say as a convenience, you would say maybe a comfort station. And naturally he entered alone to, as the Bible phrase puts it, cover his feet. But the New International is much more explicit, to relieve himself. David now had a perfect opportunity to kill Saul. His men could hardly believe how easy it was going to be. The temptation was strong. And the men of David said unto him, behold, the day which the Lord said unto thee, I will deliver thine enemy into thy hand, and thou shalt do to him as it shall seem good unto me. It's a case where it couldn't be easier. And I suppose my mind went to another occasion when David's greatest son was tempted with the suggestion, cast yourself from the pinnacle of the temple. And there was a scripture that justified it. He shall give his angels charge concerning thee, lest thou dash thy foot against a stone. They'll bear thee up. There was scripture authority for doing this. But there was another authority. Thou shalt not tempt or test the Lord thy God. And so David may have been told that one day his enemy would be in his hands. But it wasn't specific enough to mean Saul. It could be his enemies in general. And David said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do this thing unto my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to put forth mine hand against him, seeing he is the Lord's anointed." David wouldn't do that. And so he made a token gesture. While Saul was in the cave, he just used a sharp sword, no doubt, to cut off part of the king's robe. And it's interesting that he had to pacify his men. They couldn't believe that he'd passed up such an easy opportunity to kill Saul. And the phrase, "David stayed his servants," or in the New International, "rebuked his servants," is literally cut off his men. It's lovely, isn't it? He cut off the robe, and then the men said, "You know, you must be stupid." And so he had to whisper to them, "You know, no, this won't be the case." He cut them off, as it were. Well, Saul was totally unaware of how close to death he'd been. He rose up and went on his way, and David followed at a safe distance and shouted to make Saul aware of the fact that David could have killed him, but did not. And now, having made this impassioned speech explaining why he had not done this and that he had spared Saul's life, David went home. And the record tells us that Saul burst into tears. Perhaps that's a further indication of his mental instability. He did, however, recognize how close he'd come to death and that he owed his life to David's generosity. And it's interesting that as a result of this, Saul seeks David's assurance that when he became king, he would not take revenge on his family. And David, of course, gladly gave that assurance, even though a lesser man might feel that Saul, having broken promise after promise, deserved no such promise from David, and was in no position to ask others to keep a promise. Not long later, of course, the old situation returned, and David was hunted once more. And then in chapter 5, in the first verse, we read, "And Samuel died." The brevity of this statement really doesn't equal the seriousness of what happened. It's totally inadequate, isn't it, to express the tragedy, both for David and for Israel, that Samuel was now dead. And Samuel died, and all the Israelites gathered themselves together and lamented him and buried him at his house in Ramah. And I imagine David was there, perhaps inconspicuous in the crowds. Maybe his other men were with him, and they paid their last respects to this great man of Israel. And then David slipped away and went to the wilderness of Maon, almost certainly. Paran seems to be a mistake. Some texts read Maon, and scholars think that is probably more correct. And then we have this incident of Nabal. Now, you know, one can use one's imagination here quite liberally, but it provides wonderful insights again into David's character. Nabal's something of an enigma, isn't he? He was a very prosperous, but a churlish and evil man. I suppose characteristics which are not necessarily always unrelated. He was a man of great wealth, and perhaps that made him feel self-important, and so he probably didn't feel the need to continue the normal courtesies of society. And yet he had a beautiful and intelligent wife. You know, you wonder how on earth that came about. But we have to remember in those days, a woman perhaps had no choice in the husband to which she was given. And if Nabal was able to provide a large dowry to secure Abigail, this is no doubt how the marriage came about. I can't believe that she would have wished, if she had the choice, to marry such a man. Again, it's an interesting example from this morning, isn't it? That they called him Nabal, which means fool, but I suspect that was probably a nickname rather than his original given name. You can't imagine a baby being born and given the name Fool. But maybe he had a name similar, and, you know, they made it into a nickname so that it was Fool. Well, for some time, Nabal's shepherds had enjoyed the protection of David's men. David had been a shepherd himself, and he knew the difficulties of the job. He'd done it. And so David's men helped Nabal's shepherds, protecting them from marauders and so on, possibly also from animals that might attack the flock. And so at sheep shearing, which was always a time of rejoicing and a time of generous hospitality, as we shall see when we consider Absalom later, David sought assistance in the form of provisions for his own men. Now, there was no contract here, and there was no protection money. It was simply a case that David's men had given this service to Nabal's men, and it wasn't unreasonable to expect that when the time came, Nabal would invite them to the sheep shearing ceremonies and the festivities that went with it. The labourer is worthy of his hire. Nabal's flocks had prospered, David's men had contributed to that prosperity, and so, you know, as they said, David's men had been a wall to us day and night, and nothing had gone missing. And when you look at the text here in 1 Samuel 25, verse 6 onwards, you notice David's request is couched in deferential terms. It's a courteous request. It doesn't take the form of a demand or a threat. He leaves it to Nabal to decide what is appropriate. David had a generous spirit, and he expected that in other people. Well, Nabal decided what was appropriate. Nothing. He felt no obligation to David. What was worse, of course, he expressed it in very uncouth terms, pouring out abuse. Nabal answered David's servants and said, "Who is David, and who is this son of Jesse?" He knew he was, of course. "There be many servants nowadays that break away, every man from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my flesh that I have killed for my shearers and give it unto men of whom I know not whence they be?" Very much like the rich fool, isn't it? You know, "I have nowhere to place my goods. I know what I will do. I will pull down my bar." You know, it's a similar attitude, isn't it? "Shall I take my bread and my water and my flesh for my servants and give them to David's?" Nabal knew well enough who David was. Some have commented it's even possible that his remarks about servants defecting to David applied to his own servants. They'd had enough of Nabal. They wanted to be David's men. So when the messengers returned empty-handed, David felt that he'd been insulted, and he vowed to slaughter Nabal and all his sons. 400 men took up their arms in readiness and went towards Nabal's camp. Fortunately, one of Nabal's young servants had been able to get a message quickly to Abigail to explain what had happened. And in response, she made haste, knowing that David was already on his way. She was obviously concerned that there should be no slaughter of her husband, and possibly even more of her sons. She took provision. It wasn't excessive. I've worked it out at about a third of a loaf per man. It wasn't a lot, but it was better than nothing. And when she came to David, she made a twofold plea. The first thing she said was, "Please spare Nabal, and let the blame for what he's done fall on me instead." Now, I find that quite lovely. But of course, in a sense, she knew that would disarm David. How could he take revenge on her? She was a beautiful woman. And we shall see later that was always David's weakness, a soft spot. She was a beautiful woman, and she was sophisticated. How could he take revenge on her? And secondly, she made the point that David would be unwise to do anything which might cause him regret later when he became king. She virtually said, when you're king, you ought to have a clear conscience. Don't have this on your conscience, David. She, like everyone else, knew it was only a matter of time before David would be king. And as he'd not taken any vengeance on Saul and had left it to the Lord, she was suggesting that maybe this was appropriate here. "Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord." A principle that applied now and applied then. David's men accepted the provisions and turned back. After the great festivities of sheep shearing, when no doubt the wine flowed, and Nabal, of course, as you know, was merry with wine that night, when the cold light of morning dawned, and no doubt he got up with quite a heavy head, Abigail explained to him what had happened and what she had done. And it seems the shock of realizing how close he was to death and to losing all his sons proved too much, and it seems that Nabal either suffered a heart attack or maybe a stroke, possibly the latter, and he died some 10 days later. Now David recognized God's hand in this, and no doubt he was grateful that he'd heeded Abigail's wise advice not to do anything that he might later regret. But again, David's character comes through in perhaps positive and negative ways here, because David now provides for his widow. Men were sent to invite her to marry David, and she accepted. This was a wise choice, because she was beautiful, she was spiritual, She was prudent, and she was loyal, even to Nabal. And these were characteristics that David recognized and would want for a wife of his own. He wished that she would have those characteristics, and so she had. And so we come now into chapter 26, where again David encounters Saul, who's trying to find him. Saul was encamped, and David and Abishai entered the camp by night. And it's quite clear that even if guards had been posted and had been trying to be alert, it would have been in vain, because the record tells us that they were consigned to a deep sleep from the Lord. Abishai could hardly believe how easy it was going to be to make David king by just simply taking Saul's own spear and pinning him to the ground with a single blow. But David said, no, I'm not changing my rule now. I'm going to continue with the same principle. David said, as the Lord liveth, the Lord shall smite him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall go down into battle and perish. And of course, that was prophetically correct, wasn't it? That's exactly how Saul eventually died. But David took Saul's spear and the cruse of water that had been by his head to demonstrate the ease with which he could, had he wished, have destroyed Saul. And then at dawn, at a safe distance, David shouts to Abner from the hilltop, aroused from his slumber and drowsily not being able to understand what was happening. Abner asked who was shouting at the royal company. Without identifying himself, David announced that Abner was as good as dead for failing to guard the king. The king could have died while he dozed. His own life should have been forfeited. This valiant man's heart would now be in his boots, wouldn't it? If the king could have died, so could have he. And Abner still didn't recognize his voice, but Saul did. And he also realized what David had done. And again, for a while, Saul seems to appreciate David's generosity and kindness to him. Well, when we come to chapter 27, we see a change in David's lifestyle. By now, the fugitive life had become too much for David. He had wives, and presumably by now some children. This was no life for them. And the men that served him, they too would have their families, as verse 3 tells us. They couldn't go on like this much longer. Yet what could they do? Saul's repeated promises to save David, to leave him alone, to spare him, had come to nothing. They proved hollow. Where could they go to escape from Saul? Well, once again, the suggestion was made, we have no choice but to head for Philistine territory, to go to Achish, king of the Philistines. Now, I can only assume that this is a different Achish, because if the other one said get rid of him because he's out of his mind, maybe by now his son was reigning in his stead. And on this occasion, Achish was quite willing to welcome David into Gath, and he gave him a nearby city of Ziklag, which he could use as his home base. And from this city, David and his fighting men made raids on the surrounding Philistine territory. This was really audacious, if you think about it. He was in Philistine territory, he was there as the guest of a Philistine king, and yet he kept taking his men and picking off the towns of the Philistines one by one. He gave the impression, of course, that he was going out to fight Saul's men. And the Philistines seemed to accept this. The subterfuge was very clever. And the trick was the simple expedient, of course, of making sure there were no prisoners of war and that no one survived. When David attacked one of these cities, he killed everybody. So the message couldn't come back to the Philistines that he was responsible. And in this way, Achish never discovered the truth. And of course, if a traveler came past and realized the city was annihilated, that it was burnt and so on, the message would come to Achish. But the assumption would always be that it was Saul's men that had done it. And then in chapter 29, the lords of the Philistines combined their forces against Israel. And now David was placed in another predicament. How could he join forces with the Philistines against his own people? And it may be that the real problem was of David's own making, that his covert success against these various towns in the Philistine territory had made the lords of the Philistines unite in order to destroy the enemy, whom they thought, of course, was Saul. And so they combined in joint action to try to get the perpetrator of these massacres, whom they believed was Saul. Now, David was obliged to follow in with the army of Achish, but it's obvious he had no enthusiasm for this. The very phrasing of the scripture in 1 Samuel 29:2, and the lords of the Philistines passed on by hundreds and by thousands, and David and his men passed on in the rearward with Achish, you know, right at the back, hoping that they'd never get involved in the battle, presumably. But once more, the Lord came to David's rescue and provided a way of escape. Although Achish might trust David, the other lords of the Philistines were suspicious. If the battle began to go against the Philistines, or David saw an opportunity, he could easily become a fifth column, couldn't he? Something from within. And they saw this as dangerous. And of course, they recognized that although Saul and David had been enemies, if in the battle David changed sides on Saul's part and curried favor with Saul, this might be in David's favor. So, and said, send him home. Well, no doubt David was privately quite delighted at this. He would have gladly returned home, but he had to maintain his cover. So, just as previously he'd feigned madness, he was now obliged to feign disappointment. And David asks Achish, what have I done to deserve this? Nothing, says Achish, but the other lords of the Philistines won't accept you. And you can imagine David protesting, this isn't fair. All the time, you know, crossing his fingers behind his back, or whatever the equivalent was in those days. And so David complied, and he returned home. And no doubt he said to his men, you know, go slowly at first. Give the impression you're upset. Then when we're out of sight, let's go back to Ziklag. And so they did. And after a three-day march homeward in eager anticipation of being reunited with their families and their loved ones, their children, and all the home comforts, when they got back to Ziklag, it had been utterly spoiled by some surviving Amalekites. If only earlier they had utterly destroyed the men of Amalek as God required, this wouldn't have been a problem. Just imagine coming home. The houses had been no doubt set on fire, the property had been stolen, their valuables had gone, and their wives and their children had been taken into slavery. Valiant fighting men broke down and wept to exhaustion. And if you recall those lovely lists of David's top 30, you know, it says these men did incredible exploits, but they didn't make it to the top 3, or they didn't make it to the top 30, and so these were incredible warriors. And they broke down and wept until they were exhausted. And then, as so often happens, grief turned to anger. It was all David's fault. Now, you can understand how they felt. For the first time in a long time, they'd known the stability of a home where they could raise their children and live a normal family life. And now this had gone, and they wanted to stone David. This was clearly all his fault. And David's response, brothers and sisters, is an exhortation for all time. It says in chapter 30, verse 6, but David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. It's well for us to reflect on this episode. David's life had its problems. He'd experienced many joys, but probably more sorrows. And at last, when everything seemed to be going really well, tragedy had struck. Now, we have that in our own lives, don't we, brothers and sisters? We have our ups and downs. And sadly, sometimes when we least expect it, that's when the tragedy happens. This is our experience too. But David didn't blame God for what had happened. Rather, he found strength in the knowledge that this was part of God's will for him. Even if he didn't understand why, this is what God had required of him. And as his great descendant was going to say some thousand years later, not my will, but thine be done. So David now sought counsel of God by means of the Urim and Thummim in Abiathar's ephod. There's no record of his consulting God since the last time in 1 Samuel 23 when he inquired about the situation in Keilah. 600 men set off in pursuit of the Amalekites, but before long a couple of hundred could go no further. They were exhausted. This is a measure of how exhausted they were, that a couple of hundred, 200 out of the 600, just couldn't go any further. But as David was certain that he would succeed, God had promised him success, with many or with few, he pressed on. And finding a half-dead, abandoned Egyptian slave was just the stimulus that he needed and his men needed. And once they'd revived the Egyptian, of course, he became their guide to the Amalekite camp. By now, the Amalekites were celebrating the spoils of war. Unprepared for an attack, they were having a good time and no doubt boasting of the various things they'd all acquired as a result. And David's men were able to rout them in a day-long battle, and everything was recovered. When they returned to the 200 men who'd been left behind, David shared with them the extra spoil that had been recovered from the Amalekite camp. Some of those who'd been involved in the fighting with the Amalekites objected to this. They said it wasn't right. David replied that since God had given them the victory, it was only right that everyone should share in the proceeds. And you know, this was actually set down in the Law of Moses. It was there in Numbers 31, verse 27, where God said they were to divide the prey into two parts between the men skilled at war that went into battle and all the congregation. Now, for me, this demonstrates David's knowledge of the law. Again, this is something I'd like to look at in our final class on Friday, God willing. But it shows David was thoroughly acquainted with what God had said. And so he now reinstituted it as an ordinance amongst his own people, who presumably had forgotten it. And he was even more astute, because he sent some of the spoil to all those who had assisted him and supported him. No doubt towns from whom the Amalekites had also taken spoil. And David returned their treasures. And in a long list of places from Bethel to Hebron, and to all the places where David himself and his men were wont to haunt, as the record has it, he returned their property. Now, that to me demonstrates two important aspects of David's character. First, there was his generosity, evident here and elsewhere. David could have said, "This is mine, I'm king, I'm having the spoil," but no. He returned the property that the Amalekites had taken from each of these cities. He was generous to a fault, was David. I mean, we see it later, don't we, when he purchased the threshing floor of Arauna the Jebusite, and when he prepared the material for Solomon's temple, which, again, we must look at later. And, of course, the other side of it was a good political expedient, wasn't it? David was an astute king. He knew by returning the property to each of these towns and cities round about that had been despoiled by the Amalekites, that this would cement their relationship and ensure that when David eventually came to the throne, he had considerable support in the country. And then when we begin the second book of Samuel in chapter 1, we read of the death of Saul and the Amalekite messenger, of course, who came to bring the news to David. While David was engaged in recovering his family from the Amalekites, Saul and, it seems, also Jonathan had been killed on Mount Gilboa. And it was an Amalekite who brought the news to David. Now, when you compare the two accounts, the end of 1 Samuel 31 and the beginning of 2 Samuel chapter 1, there seems to be, at first sight, superficially, a disparity in the accounts. But actually, when you put it together, there are elements that ring true, and I think it is possible to reconcile the two accounts. In fact, what I've done in my notes is set them out in a table, and the equivalent paragraphs and verses set against each other. But if I might summarise it, because we're running out of time now, if I might summarise it, it comes something like this. It seems that once Saul had been wounded by the archers, he was concerned that he might be captured and tortured. Even at the end of his life, he was no king, was he? He was terrified that these uncircumcised might come and abuse him. So he sought a rapid end to his life at the hands of his armor-bearer. He asked his armor-bearer, "Thrust me through." But the armor-bearer wouldn't do this. He wasn't willing to dispatch him. So Saul then fell on his own sword. But that proved ineffectual. And it seems at that moment the Amalekite appeared, and Saul asked him to finish him off. The Amalekite considered that Saul wouldn't recover, and so he put him out of his misery, as it were. At this point, the armor-bearer seems to realize that now he was in difficulty, so he took his own life. And then the Amalekite removed Saul's crown and his bracelet to take them to David as proof of Saul's death and to seek a reward. And the record says, of course, on the next day, when the Philistines came to strip the bodies to take any valuables that might be there, they found Saul's body. They cut off his head, they decapitated the corpse, recovered his armor, but there's no mention of a crown or a bracelet, because, of course, by this time the Amalekite had taken them to David. So I think the two stories do fit together quite nicely. So it's evident that Saul attempted unsuccessfully to take his own life, and the Amalekite seems to have obliged him by imparting the final blow. He went to David and looked for a reward. He received it, but it wasn't the one he'd anticipated. David put him to death. He'd claimed that he'd killed the Lord's anointed to win David's favor, but clearly he didn't understand the David he was dealing with. He was unaware, apparently, of David's attitude in sparing Saul on these previous occasions. Now, you may feel, and I'm a little worried about this, that there's some injustice here. It could be argued that the Amalekite had acted in good faith. He'd put Saul out of his misery, and then he'd taken the proof of Saul's death to David. But I just wonder if there's more to it than that. The question is, what was an Amalekite doing just wandering past in the battle? It doesn't make sense, does it? You know, out for a stroll for the day and he comes across a battle. It doesn't make sense. So we've got to ask, why is he there? And I wonder if he was a mercenary who opportunistically changed sides. And this, of course, angered David. Or was it just that David wanted to make an example of him to deter others who might later want to raise their hands against the Lord's anointed, that is David, or the Lord's anointed, say, a priest? And it may be that, again, David was using the principle laid down in God's law that this was wrong against the Lord's anointed. So David put him to death. We can't help but be moved by David's lamentation for Saul, as well as Jonathan. And again, that's interesting. It's like Samuel, who mourned for Saul. David now mourns for him. He felt it deeply. A wonderful demonstration of the attitude of these godly men, isn't it? They felt deeply for the things of God, not their own personal preferences or personal gain. They were all, in effect, men after God's own heart. But David still didn't assume the throne at this point, did he? He sought counsel of the Lord. And then he had to try and reconcile the two parts of his kingdom. We come into 2 Samuel chapter 3, where we find Abner now is at risk of being redundant. So he tried to set up a counter kingdom and took Ish-bosheth, Saul's descendant, and set him up as king instead of David. And so David had to go to war again. It says there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. David waxed stronger and stronger, but the house of Saul waxed weaker and weaker. It was through much tribulation, wasn't it, that David entered his kingdom. When Abner saw which way things were going, he eventually changed sides, didn't he, and defected to David. And David said, "I'll accept your support on two conditions. First, you must return Michal, my wife, who had been given by Saul to someone else. And then Abner would have to go and win support for David." The first condition was very important. It wasn't that he particularly wanted his wife back, because, as we know, they were estranged. It was politically expedient that the daughter of Saul should return to David's household, to emphasize that he was Saul's son-in-law. And, of course, the second was essential in uniting the nation. Well, when Joab discovered that Abner was feathering his own nest and therefore a potential rival, on the pretense of settling the score on behalf of Asahel, his brother, he murdered Abner in cold blood. I don't think we should pity Abner too much. He opposed David, although he knew, no doubt, like everyone else, that David was divinely appointed, and he deserted Ish-bosheth to further his own career. And it's quite obvious, isn't it, that David's character is so different from the contemporaries. The next chapter in 2 Samuel 4 illustrates this so well. When the two sons of Rimmon, Rechab and Baanah, murdered Ish-bosheth and brought his head to David, seeking a reward and thinking they'd done him a service, he executed them. David was consistent in his attitude about those who sought to solve problems by their own means, and in particular, of course, by cold-blooded murder like this. There was now no reason for Israel to hold out anymore. 7.5 years had passed with no consolidation of the kingdom, but now David was anointed king for the third time as king over all Israel. And so, brothers and sisters, we followed in our first two studies the path of David. David had come from following the sheep of his father to leading and shepherding God's flock as king over Israel.